Last week we finished 1 Samuel 14. The vignette, of course, was Jonathan precipitating a war with the Philistines. He took out a Philistine garrison in the Saddle of Benjamin, and that brought a punitive expedition up from the Philistines. And then Saul got Israelites together at Gilgal, and they came up to the saddle themselves, and then Jonathan once again took out, I'm assuming, another garrison, threw them into panic, and the Israelites then drove them off the saddle, and we get an insight into Saul as a commander, as a king, and so forth. And what we saw this time is two things. One is Saul is not hearing from the Lord, and that just naturally bothers him, of course. And the other is that he tends to be emotional and rash. So as they were driving the Philistines, he issued a command saying, nobody eats until we're done. And of course, you know, Jonathan didn't get the message, and he has some honey. But the more important thing is his soldiers are unable to complete the pursuit. So the victory is not nearly so great as it might have been. So that's sort of our first insight into Saul. And we'll get another one tonight. The other thing we mentioned is, although Jonathan had eaten some honey in defiance of his order, it was an order that Jonathan never got. So there wasn't any defiance there. And they were not willing to turn Jonathan in. The map I've gotten back of me, there are several maps of this, and this is as good as any. Obviously a map of biblical Israel, and it's on bibleatlas.org/region/amalek.jpg for those out in streaming land or podcast land. But a couple of things I want to show you on this. You see the pink lines, that's Saul's kingdom. That's what he controls. And then you see the yellow lines, which are Philistia. Where we're going to be tonight is down south of Saul's kingdom, and you see there Amalek, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. The thing I want to show you before we get into tonight's reading is you see that pink tongue that goes from east to west, that goes up into Saul's kingdom from the Shephelah, or the plain of Sharon. And that's the Beth Horon ridge route that goes from the flat by the Mediterranean up into the Saddle of Benjamin. That area is always an area of contention because whoever controls that basically controls both east-west travel between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, and they also control north-south travel from Judah on up to Ephraim and the northern part of the kingdom. So all of the action last time was in dispute of that pink tongue that we see coming up into the Saddle of Benjamin. It's key strategic territory. It is to this day key strategic territory. Just to orient you, the tip of the tongue is Jerusalem. And of course, north of that is Ephraim. I also wanted you to see where Amalek was in general, so as we start naming places and stuff, you can see what we're dealing with. So, we're in 1 Samuel 15. And Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did in opposing them on the way when they came out of Egypt." Them and they, by the way, is Israel. Let me read that again. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." So those are the instructions. And to remind you, in our weekly Torah portion reading, 2 weeks ago, we had that incident. And that was when Israel comes out of Egypt, and they're out in the wilderness, and Amalek attacks them, and that was the one where Moses is sitting on a rock, and Aaron and Hur hold his arms up, because as long as he holds his rod up, Israel prevails, but when he gets tired and his arms drop, Amalek prevails. So that's what is being referred to here, that battle in Exodus. And in that battle, Israel did prevail. But God was grumpy with the whole thing and wants Amalek to be gotten rid of. As an interesting historical note, we're going to see Amalek quite a bit because obviously Saul doesn't completely get rid of him. So at the end of Saul's life, when he is being struck down by the Philistines up north, remember with the business of the witch at Endor and so forth, a young man comes upon him and he is mortally wounded, and the young man allegedly finishes him off. And the stories vary depending on whether you read the story at the end of 1 Samuel or at the beginning of 2 Samuel. The stories are slightly different. And this guy comes down to David, and he's bringing news of Saul's death, which he assumes David is going to regard as wonderful news. So he comes down there to announce to David that Saul is dead and very much expecting to be rewarded. And this guy says, yeah, I saw him mortally wounded and he asked me to finish him off, so I did. And the last thing he says is, I am an Amalekite. So an Amalekite that Saul does not finish off in 1 Samuel 15 is going to be the one who finally kills him in the end of the book. The other place they show up, the Amalekites, is in the book of Esther. Haman is an Amalekite. So we see the Amalekites over and over and over again showing up in Israel's history, always in a negative way for Israel. So as we read through this, just keep all that in mind who we're dealing with. So verse 4. So Saul summoned the people and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 men on foot and 10,000 men of Judah. Now, I don't know if that is 210,000 or 200,000 of which 10,000 are Judah. I just don't know which way that is. Because remember, Saul is a Benjaminite. Saul is not from either Judah or Ephraim. And Saul came to the city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. Then Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart, go down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the people of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. I confuse the Kenites and the Kenizzites, and I don't know if they're the same peoples. I just don't know the answer to that, because you remember in the book of Judges, where we have the incident with Deborah, Jael, who's the one who kills Sisera, is a Kenite. So I don't know. But anyway, they're not Israelites apparently, but they're allies, so Saul says, get out of the way. Verse 7, and Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, of the oxen, of the fatted calves, and the lambs. All that was good, they would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless, they devoted to destruction. So now, two things going on here. We'll see in just a minute that Saul's excuse is, well, we kept the best stuff to sacrifice. Reading this, it doesn't seem like that. What it feels like reading in verse 15:9 is they looked at all this really good livestock and stuff and say, what do you mean destroy all this? And they fell upon it as spoil, as opposed to for sacrifice. I think the sacrifice thing is something Saul says to make a bad situation look as good as possible. Verse 10, the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And Samuel was angry, and he cried to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, set up a monument for himself, and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed be you of the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. In other words, I did what you told me to do. And Samuel said, What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen that I hear? That has got to be the funniest line in the entire Bible. Talk about dripping with sarcasm. I chuckle every time I read that. Of course, Saul's not going to chuckle. He's upset. Verse 15. Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord our God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction. Then Samuel said to Saul, Stop. I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night. And he said to him, Speak. So this is the second time Saul has done this. He gets caught out doing something wrong, and he immediately starts chattering, trying to justify himself and trying to make himself look good. He did that at the sacrifice at Gilgal a couple of chapters back, when Samuel told him to wait 7 days, and he didn't wait, and went ahead and did the sacrifice. And of course, when Samuel showed up, he then made excuses. Well, he's doing it again here. You can just see this exchange taking place. Saul is going into chatter mode, trying to deflect the chewing out that he knows he's going to get. Samuel isn't buying a second of it and just says, Shut up. I'm going to talk. You're going to listen. That's literally the tone of the conversation here. I will tell you what the Lord has said to me tonight. That's Bible speak of, I'm going to talk and you're going to listen. Saul said to him, Speak. And Samuel said, Though you were little in your own eyes, were you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, Go devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? So Samuel's read of the situation is pretty much the same as what I got out of it, that the idea of bringing it for a sacrifice is a excuse after the fact. What they were doing was pouncing on the spoil. The comment was, this is a sign of his character as a leader, which I completely agree with. One of the things that I was told fairly early in my life in the Army was, when you're in trouble, never complain, never explain. Just shut your mouth. Take your chewing out and go do what you're supposed to do. Comment was in verse 12 in the Septuagint, there's some extra verbiage that my Masoretic text doesn't have, which is to the effect that Samuel rose and went to Saul, and Saul was making an offering of the spoil at that time. So that would put a slightly rosier look on Saul than the Masoretic text does. However, having said that, he is not sacrificing all of it. He is simply making a sacrifice of the spoil, which would have been sort of a normal procedure. So I'm back now down to verse 20. And Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission in which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord our God at Gilgal. So, again, deflecting blame. The point is, his job was specifically destroy everything that breathes. And let's back up a second before we go on. Remember last week we had this rash command that he issued. that nobody's supposed to eat until the end of the day and we've won our victory. He made that rashly in a fit of emotion, and he sticks to it. So he is capable of enforcing an order when he wants to. Here, his order from God via Samuel is kill everything that breathes. He didn't do it. So the first thing he does is bring back the king, and there was no instruction to do that. And then, of course, he brings back the best of the livestock out of which he is making a sacrifice. And now that he has been yelled at, he deflects and says, wasn't my fault. People got out of control there. Well, which is it? Are you able to control the people with this rash oath that you made in the previous battle, or are the people out of control? You see again this vacillation that the guy has, and the fact that when he gets in trouble, he tries to make excuses, deflect blame, etc., instead of, as I say, just taking his chewing out and moving on. Verse 22. And Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. Now, this is the second time Saul has been told, your kingdom isn't going to last. 24. Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. If you're in the Septuagint, we already got sacrifices going on. So what he's doing is he's saying, and he'll say this again, okay, please forgive me, and oh, by the way, do not disrespect me in front of the army. That's the message here. Verse 26, and Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. So Saul is saying, please don't disrespect me in front of the army. Samuel is saying, tough. You did it, you live with it. 27. As Samuel turned to go away, Saul seized the skirt of his robe and it tore. So as Samuel is getting ready to leave, Saul grabs him in desperation, trying to get him to stay so that he doesn't look like a chump in front of the army. 28. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the glory of Israel will not lie or have regret, for he is not a man that he should have regret. Then he said, I have sinned. Yet honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel. Return with me that I may bow before the Lord your God. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul bowed before the Lord. So Samuel relents and goes back with him instead of leaving him with egg all over his face in front of everybody. Now, one of the things we'll see as we go through this is Samuel is brokenhearted over Saul. Samuel really likes Saul. He keeps praying for him. He keeps hoping for something. And when he dies, Samuel weeps over him. So it is the case that this is not personal with Samuel. Samuel is simply doing what God told him to do, and in Samuel's eyes, sadly, Saul has failed. Now the comment was, Saul's trying to deflect the blame to the people. It sounds very much like Aaron trying to deflect the blame over the golden calf. I would agree with that. So all the way down to verse 32. Then Samuel said, bring here to me Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And Agag came to him cheerfully. Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. Now, I have no idea why Agag is cheerful. My note is, or haltingly, and the Septuagint apparently has something different yet. And it says here, the Hebrew is uncertain. Now, as I say, I have no idea why Agag would be cheerful. He's just lost his entire kingdom, almost certainly his family, and everything else. I would think the translation in New King James is fearfully would be certainly more in keeping with the situation. According to Strong's, the word is cheerful. 33. And Samuel said, as your word has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So Samuel is ticked. He is in an emotional state having to bear the bad news to Saul. And then instead of being able to stomp off into the hill country, he has been brought back. So he's also in a highly emotional and agitated state. So when it says hacked into pieces, this was not just a single swift thrust through the heart and expire. It was more something like you would see in a slasher movie. 34. Then Samuel went to Ramah, and Saul went up to his house in Gibeah of Saul. And Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. And Samuel grieved over Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. Samuel genuinely liked Saul, so he's very upset with the way it's turned out. Chapter 16. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. Here, obviously, God is going to take a second swing at making a king. Now, as I said before, a couple of times ago when Saul was chosen, if you look at Saul on paper and you look at his early career, he's ideal. Tall, good-looking, from a buffer tribe, modest, brave, strong. If you were making a checklist for who's going to be king, he would make all the boxes. It's only as he comes under stress that you start to see the character flaws that he has. And he hasn't had those character flaws tested at the time he's anointed. Now, that tells me something interesting, or at least it's interesting to me. God doesn't know what you're going to do until you do it. He's going to try again with David, who is also a very charismatic young man. And of course, David is going to succeed. And despite David's failures, he's always going to be the Lord's man. But I personally don't believe that God chose Saul with the intention of having him fail. I think Saul's failure was as much a surprise and disappointment to God as it was to Samuel. And David's success will be the opposite. There are instructions about being a king in Moses. And what it says is, if you choose a king, then he'll write his own Torah, and he won't amass a whole lot of wives and a whole lot of horses and a whole lot of wealth. And oh, by the way, he's also got to be an Israelite. That's Moses's synopsis of being a king. When Israel demands a king, back here in 1 Samuel, then Samuel says, and God ratifies, that you guys are making a big mistake, because what you really want is God to be king over you and not a regular king. But if that's what you want, we'll do it. And he'll take the best of your stuff, the best of your land, the best of your vineyards, the best of your people, and he'll tax you, what is it, 20%? Something like that. And you won't like it, but we'll do it if you want to. That's in 1 Samuel. I don't think Moses says anything like that. But then at the end of the day, both God and Samuel say, if, however, your king will follow me and will do what's right in my eyes, it'll be okay. And of course, mostly they don't. David is a very different character than Saul is. But as I say, both of them are good-looking, charismatic, brave in battle, all of that kind of stuff. But David's character is different than Saul's character. You're absolutely correct. So I'm all the way down to verse 2 in chapter 16. And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord,' and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do." So Samuel, having told Saul that he's out, is now obviously afraid of doing anything concrete to make that happen, because he expects Saul will take action to stop him. Now verse 3, "And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what to do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" Now, I have no idea what the problem is here, but I am guessing when the judge of Israel shows up in your town, it is sort of like having a prophet show up in your town. He's not there because you're doing a good job. The only reason he would be there is because something's wrong. So they come up to him and say, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." Again, the idea here is Jesse's sons are tall, strong, good-looking, charismatic, etc. So as he looks at each one of them, it's, wow, this guy'd make a great king. Verse 7, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as a man sees. A man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart.' Then Jesse called Aminadab and made him pass before Samuel, and he said, 'Neither has the Lord chosen this one.' Then Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, 'Neither has the Lord chosen this one.' And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, 'The Lord has not chosen these.' Then Samuel said to Jesse, 'Are all your sons here?' And he said, 'There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep.' And Samuel said to Jesse, 'Send and get him for me. We will not sit down till he comes here.'" So David is the kid brother, and everybody gets to go to the feast, and somebody's got to watch the sheep, so it's your job. Verse 12, "And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord says, 'Arise, anoint him, for this is he.' And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah." So David gets anointed like Saul did before he does anything. He's God's pick. So now what we're going to have is some non sequiturs. We're going to get David's service to Saul to the end of the chapter. And then we're going to get David and Goliath. And in the story of David and Goliath, Saul is not going to recognize David. So the story is written out of order, if you will. It's not chronological. Verse 14, "Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him. And Saul's servant said to him, 'Behold, how a harmful spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is skillful in playing the lyre. And when the harmful spirit from God is upon you, he shall play it and you will be well.'" One of the things that appears to be the case is biblical prophecy, at least at this point in the book, appears to be very often accompanied by music. Music seems to be something that stirs up the prophetic spirit. We'll see it in Kings or Chronicles, I don't remember which, where one of the kings of Israel asked for a prophet, and the prophet says, "You got any musicians?" And they get a musician to show up, and the musician starts playing, and then the prophet is able to prophesy. Comment was, the Psalms, of course, are all musical. So music, at least very often, seems to be an integral part of the prophetic process. And so in Saul's case, when he's got harmful spirit tormenting him, the idea is to play some music and soothe him, calm him down so that he'd be able to rest. Verse 17. So Saul said to his servants, "Provide for me a man who can play well and bring him to me." One of the young men answered, "Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him." This is David's resume before David has done anything. 19. Therefore Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me David your son, who is with the sheep." And Jesse took a donkey laden with bread and a skin of wine and a young goat and sent them by David his son to Saul. And David came to Saul and entered his service, and Saul loved him greatly. And he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David remain in my service, for he has found favor in my sight." And whenever the harmful spirit from God was upon Saul, David took the lyre and played it with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the harmful spirit departed from him. A couple of things here. When we get down to the story of David and Goliath, and David goes out and slays Goliath, Saul says, "Who is that guy?" Now, here it says that David is Saul's armor bearer. So it's just the stories are out of sequence is all it is. But as you read it, just be aware that the sequence here is not chronological. And having said that, armor bearer may in fact be a titular thing. In other words, you have the position of the king's armor bearer. You have the position of the king's chamberlain. You know, that kind of thing. It may be ceremonial. In fact, among the kings of England, there was a keeper of the stool whose job it was to go in with the king when he was moving his bowels and make sure that all the stuff he needed in that process was there. And apparently it was a highly coveted position because you got to be with the king in intimate moments and you found out all sorts of stuff and had quite a bit of influence. So it was not considered to be a, how should we say it, garbage man position, you know, where only the lowest people. No, the nobles contended for that position because of the access that it afforded. So in answer to your question, I have no idea whether he ever bore Saul's armor in battle. It may simply have been a court title that he was given, you know, sort of a pay grade. Okay, you're the armor bearer, this is your pay grade, and this is how much you get every pay period. I have no idea, just don't know. The other thing that's going on is there are warnings about what a king is going to do. And one of the warnings is he's going to take the best of your young men to be in his army and run before his chariots. This is an example of that. David, according to his resume here, "Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing, a man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a man of good presence, and the Lord is with him." I mean, that's a pretty high recommendation. So Saul, the king, on getting that kind of a resume from a young man who was also able to relieve his depression, says, "Okay, you're part of the court now," which is exactly what Samuel and God both said was going to happen, and it does continue to happen.